I'm out to Watson, and I'm an alcoholic. And because a loving God was with me on the night of December 31st, 1973, girls, it doesn't get any better than this. Can I move this way? Because a loving God was with me on the night of December 31st of 1973 and stayed that night with me and led me to you people, and since that time has generally worked through you, I've not had a drink since that time. At this time sober with you, I am indeed grateful. Saying that you can't hear me reminds me that I was in the elevator today with one of the bellhops, and he said, you sound like your throat's as bad as mine. And I didn't tell him that this is as good as it gets. If I'd have stayed out there much longer drinking that whiskey, I'd have been up here with sign language tonight. I truly want to thank the committee for inviting me, Marianne and Marge and Elsie and Pam, and particularly little Nancy that came to the airport to meet us yesterday, twice. And it was a long, hard day of frustrations, and we were tired when we got here. But I'll tell you one thing, it happened like it happens anywhere. You know, we went to that meeting last night and heard Louise make the bell ringer talk, and everything was all right. And isn't that the way it always is? Everything was all right. I need to tell you a little bit about the personality of the Martha that started drinking. It was a lot of work for me to screw my life up to get here. I think it is for all of us. We're so good at it, we make it look easy, but it's really a lot of hard work, or it was for me. When I was old enough to walk and talk, I started marching around in back of my father, patterning everything about me after that man. And I know today that he was a full-blown alcoholic. So I was rigging myself for this disease right then. He was a very hard and harsh and direct man. And I came right along in back of him, acting just like he did, except that I later found out he was a marshmallow inside, and I'd overshot the mark, and I was hard to the core, all the way to the core. I watched him steamroll people, and I learned to steamroll. He had my mother totally under his thumb, and I had her wrapped around mine by the time I was 10 years old. I acted just like him, and I look like him, I talk like him, I think like him. Sometimes I swear like him. I tried to drink like him, and I damn near died like him. The first line in their big book with which I could identify was that alcoholics are like tornadoes roaring through the lives of others. And I knew what that meant. Because I had roared through a lot of lives, and I'd left a lot of dead bodies along the way. So that's the personality that I added the alcohol to. Now, I was a late bloomer with booze. I couldn't find my magic elixir for a little while. I stayed busy with one shot of bourbon, mixing it with water and 7-Up. And by the time I got it just right, the party was always over. And I know that you're not going to make this program if that's the way you're going to drink. But I found my magic elixir, and I doubled up and I caught up. Now, I wish I could stand here right now and tell you the style and grace with which I drank. A lot of you got here in real bad health, with your stomachs blown out and your liver shot, and I got here healthy as a horse. But my feet were gone. Because everything I did drinking, I did to my feet. And I can assure you that once you stop drinking, that liver will pump back up again, that stomach will straighten out, and when the feet are gone, they're just gone. And the ladies that can see my feet tonight think, well, at least she had the good sense to wear her walking shoes. Walking shoes, hell, these are my dress shoes. You ought to see what I'm wearing when I'm comfortable. I was always breaking toes, one or two at a time, or I broke every bone in my right foot at one time. You can look through my photograph album, and anytime I'm on vacation, the pictures, I'm either on crutches, or I'm leaning on a cane, or I'm sitting in a wheelchair, or I had one or two ace bandages on my feet. And then you come to the part where I'm not in any of those things. You know, that's when I sobered up. Because I've been sober a little over 13 years now, and I haven't broken anything in my feet. I went to Hawaii, and before I sobered up, about a year before I sobered up. And there was some mix-up. I seem to be associated with mix-ups on airlines. But at any rate, they gave us free booze from Los Angeles into Honolulu. And there wasn't a drop of nothing left when we landed. And everybody went to the hotel but me, and I went to the hospital. Because I'd pulled all the ligaments in my left ankle and foot. The September before I came to you in December, I had a half-brother. And he was stationed in London, and Dad said, if you're ever going to Europe, you ought to go while your brother's there. So Dad said it, you know, that's what I did. And I broke two toes the night before I left. So there I was over in Europe in my canvas house slippers. I never had to pack shoes when I went anywhere. I was always in house slippers. And every now and then I'd hurt something besides my feet. I took a party home with me one time, a Christmas party. And I'm the only one that got tangled up in the telephone cord while we were dancing. And I ripped my right ear nail all the way off. But it was a good party, so I just held it up there. And when everybody left, then I went to the emergency room. I have one claim to being unique, and God, we all love to be unique. And I have a scar up here that I got when I got a whiplash in my living room. What can I tell you? I can assure you, if you're falling hard enough and fast enough, when your head hits a coffee table, you can do it at home. You don't even have to mess up your car or anything. I never associate any of these accidents with alcohol. Ever. I hear people all the time talking about how long they knew they were an alcoholic before they came here. It had never crossed my mind. And having the personality that I had, nobody had ever mentioned to me that there was a possibility. When I came to y'all, I told you I'd been having trouble with alcohol for about 6 months. And I've been breaking feet for 30 years. But 6 months before I came to y'all, some strange things started happening in my life. I was celebrating my natural birthday in June before I came in December. And the next day I didn't remember it. And I assumed I had passed out. Till people started mentioning some of the things I'd been doing. And I realized I'd been on my feet. But my denial system was in place right then. Because I didn't think that was strange. Primarily because I didn't think about it at all. And during that last 6 months, I had big gaps missing from my life. And I never once thought it was strange. Because I never once thought about it. I just went on. But I suppose subconsciously it must have bothered me, because after that first one, I checked myself into the diagnostic clinic there in Houston. And I came out of there with a diagnosis that said emotional reaction depression. And I didn't know what that meant. I knew that emotional, and I was going to pay for it in an insurance company. It wasn't. I knew that much. And I came out taking Elevils and Valium. And I took them with my scotch. So because my doctor hadn't bothered to tell me not to drink with this medication for a very good reason. I hadn't bothered to tell him I drank. I was sober a couple of years when I went to one of our Texas state conventions and I heard a lady say something that I could identify with. She said that when alcoholics were sick, that they really ought to go to veterinarians because they're accustomed to guessing what's wrong with the patient. So I know today that I am not only alive, but I'm alive and sober by God's grace. Because that same combination has killed a lot of us. But that's the way I finished my drinking, was with Elevels and Valium, and taking them with my scotch. There were a lot of times missing in my life. Louise said something last night that sounded like she was telling my story. I got up one morning to go to the grocery store, and I couldn't find my car. And I looked everywhere for that car. And I finally reported it stolen, and there was some pretty good evidence came up after I was sober that it's entirely possible that I loaned it to somebody. I gave it away. I never knew what happened to it. But now that I understand blackouts, I have a feeling that it was not stolen. When I went to see this brother in England that I mentioned a little while ago, he took me to the airport and to send me home, or for me to go home. He wasn't sending me because I'd acted good. I drank on a daily basis and I didn't get in any trouble. Imagine that. But I thought, well, I've come this far. So I just went on to Amsterdam and Paris. And he thought I'd gone home. The family thought I was still with him. And I bring this up to tell you about an incident that happened. Elleville made me real thirsty. And I didn't even speak French. So I had somebody write down ice water on a piece of paper and wine, and I'd just hand them my slip of paper and get my ice water and my wine. And I had been on a tour that Saturday morning, and it ended right at the sidewalk cafe, and I went in and handed them my slip of paper and got my wine and my ice water. And then I decided on these old crippled feet that I would walk Paris. And I started up the Champs-Élysées. And I had to stop at a lot of sidewalk cafes. And I didn't get very far where my feet gave out. And so I took a cab back to the hotel. And I started writing some postcards. And I mixed a drink. And the next time I saw me, it was Sunday. And I didn't remember Saturday. And there again, I didn't think it was strange because I didn't think about it at all. And I had no idea what I'd done on Saturday night in Paris. Until I got my pictures developed. And apparently I had a fine time. I had only been back from that trip about 3 weeks when my father died. And it was a very traumatic time for me, but I'm the only one that knew that. Because steamrollers don't cry. And steamrollers don't tell you they're hurting. And I went home, I was raised in Northeast Texas in Greenville. And I went to Greenville for the services, and I went up there to handle things, as I'm sure he had trained me to do. And y'all know what I did. I went up there to run the show as I trained myself to do. And I don't like remembering the Martha at that funeral. Sitting there in that little house with the Baptist minister there and having a drink and him finally saying that if I wouldn't mind, would put my drink aside, that he'd like to pray with the family. And my saying to him, you do what you got to do, and I'll do what I got to do. With all the arrogance that we can have when we're drinking. My mother and father had remarried then. They had divorced earlier and they had remarried. And since Daddy had taken care of her, I figured it was my job to take care of her. And I was not overly fond of the lady. I know today that that hostility came from the fact that when they divorced, she took me away from him and we moved to Dallas. But I had to do what he did. And I can tell you, I took a lot better care of her than she ever intended. That Thanksgiving, I was going to Greenville to spend it with her because I couldn't let her spend it alone. Daddy would have been with her, so I had to go with her. And I got up that morning to drive home, and I didn't feel good. And I checked the scotch bottle to see if maybe that was why. And there was only about that much gone, so I knew that wasn't the problem. I was always doing that. I was always checking the scotch bottle, and there was never much gone. I didn't know I was drinking just one drink when I was hitting the road, and I was running all over town. But at any rate, I drove to Greenville, and I stayed 4 days, and I made Mother miserable, and then I came home. And when I got to work on Monday, I checked the answering service. There were a whole lot of people for me to call. They had called in on Friday, and I started returning those calls. And they were all people I'd met while I was out Wednesday night, and I didn't know I'd been anyplace. And I didn't think that was strange, because I didn't think about it. My car was replaced by the insurance company about 3 weeks after it disappeared. And I made such a good deal on that car that the salesman and I got drunk in the showroom. It never occurred to me that if he had something to celebrate, I hadn't made too good a deal. And we were asked to leave, and I had to pass that dealership at least once a week and generally two or three times a week. And I have to remember every time I passed it that that's a strange place to be asked to leave. Well, the following Monday was New Year's Eve. And I worked. I never missed a day of work from drinking. I just turned up there and suffered. And made everybody else suffer, too. And I planned to stay home that night because I didn't drink with the amateurs. I just drank with the pros. And I had no idea how much truth there was in that statement. And I went home that night. It was the coldest night that we had in Houston that year. And I put on a warm robe and some warm slippers, and I had a potato bacon, and I had a steak marinating, and I fixed a drink. And the next time I saw me, I was in a long black dress, slit up to the knee, and I didn't have my glasses on. I'm blind without my glasses, and I couldn't breathe through my nose, and I couldn't bend my knees, and I was in jail. And I didn't know how any of those things happened. Least of all, how I ended up in jail. And that's why when I give my sobriety date, I always say a loving God was with me. Because that night brought me to my knees. It was the most shameful and degrading experience of my life. But I want you all to understand I had done much more shameful and degrading things than going to jail. But I'd done them by choice. And this had not been my choice. And I don't think I could have stayed that night and stayed sane if my God hadn't been with me. And I knew later that I had taken our first step that night in jail. That for the first time ever, I admitted that alcohol indeed was a problem in my life. And I assumed I'd been in a car wreck again because I had all those old familiar aches and pains. And about midnight, they let me used the telephone, and I called a nephew. I'd gotten him out of jail a time or two. A turnabout was fair play. And he did come down to get me, but the accident division had a hold on me, and they kept me till 5 the next morning. And he took me home, and I didn't drink that day. I have not had a bad day in sobriety. No. Because any day that doesn't seem exactly right, I laid up beside that sucker, and they all look good. They all look good. And I've never had a day like that since. I called a nephew that's a lawyer to see if he could find out why I'd been in jail. I think it's amazing they don't tell you why you're in jail. But he said he couldn't find out that day, but he could the next day. And so on the 2nd of January, he called and found out that I had rear-ended another car just a few blocks from home in my brand new car. And I'd been in jail by 8 o'clock. And after I found out that I had not really harmed anybody, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know why it was necessary to find out. And I don't even try to wonder why it was necessary to find out. But I would not make the call until I found out. And I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing I knew about it, I'd had a date one night with a fellow that was in AA. And he was strange. He just sat and watched me drink. And that had never been my style. So we didn't do that twice. So all I really knew about you was that you took a dim view of drinking. And that's all I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. But I didn't care if you were a room full of barracudas. Beat the hell out of jail. And I called our intergroup office, and they sent exactly the right two women to bring me the message of our program. Because if you'd sent some of them, I'd have steamrolled right over them. And if you'd sent others, you'd been so soft, I couldn't have heard you. But he sent exactly the right two people to bring me the message of our program. And they say I was the easiest 12-step call they ever made. Because, you see, I misunderstood everything I heard when I got here. And if I'd understood it, I'd have gotten drunk. But I thought our fellowship was a lot like a leper colony. That once you came in, you couldn't leave. And that to stay, you couldn't drink. So, no matter how badly I wanted to drink, I couldn't because I was in AA. Well, if you're that sick and that stupid when you get here, it simplifies the hell out of your program, I'll tell you that. I'm as dry up here as if I'd had 10 elevators. But I assure you I have not. But you know, when those women would tell me that I was going to 90 meetings in 90 days, I went. I didn't know I could say I ain't going. I don't feel like it. I don't need a meeting. I didn't know any of these things. I thought I had to do what they told me to do. And I know that I got sober a lot easier than some of you did because of what I misunderstood. I didn't know any better than to follow directions. And there is an easier, softer way to get sober. And that's, by God, follow directions. They told me my best thinking had gotten me here. And that they would just think for me. And they did. They truly did. They told me everything to do, and they just told me everything. I just was sort of a vegetable that they led around on a string. But I've got to tell you, that's the easier, softer way. Louise mentioned it still being teachable, and I hope I am, but I'll tell you one thing, not nearly as much as I was in the beginning. Not nearly as much as I was in the beginning. They brought our program to me on a Wednesday, and we decided, since I couldn't bend my knees, and I lived upstairs, that they would come back on Friday and take me to a meeting that they went to, a step meeting. And I called them about every 2 or 3 hours for 3 days, reminding them not to forget to come and get me, because I sure wanted to go to that meeting. And by Friday, I'd stepped it up to about every 30 minutes. Because, you see, they told me when they brought me our program that I never had to go to jail again. Ever again. And they told me about blackouts, and they told me this was a disease. And they told me it was like an elevator, and I could get off on any floor. And I remembered that steel mesh elevator in jail, and they said I never had to do that again. So I can tell you that I was sweet willing to stop drinking when I got here, because I never wanted to go to jail again. Now, they tell me also that the first 6 months that all I did was talk about jail. The step meeting that I went to, I could work jail on all 12 steps. And I really didn't know what kind of outfit I joined. At about my third meeting, I was called on and I was talking about jail. And afterwards, everybody came up and congratulated me on this, on going to jail. And I thought, this is a weird group. And I know now that one night in jail, that's not a bad price to pay for your life. Not a bad price. But it sure sounded strange at the time. They had left me literature to read, and I read it, and I cannot tell you how grateful I felt when I read our 12 steps. Because I don't know about anybody in this room, but don't to this alcoholic meant do it or die. I had set unattainable goals all of my life and attained them. And here were just 12 positive tools, not a don't in the bunch. Now, I will admit that they're not quite as easy to do as it looked to be on first reading. But I did learn that I had indeed taken the first step my night in jail. You really don't have much trouble dealing with unmanageability when you're in your living room one minute and the next minute you're in jail. You know, there's no question there about unmanageability. And when I saw our second step, the thing that came to my mind first was daring to drink in Paris when no one even knew where I was, where I didn't speak the language. I mean, I could still be in jail in Paris, for God's sake. And that's the sort of insanity that the second step talks to me about, not the silly hats and horns behavior that we do under the influence of alcohol, but the insanity to drink when we know what it's doing to us. I really and truly did not think I would have any trouble at that third step because I got here knowing and loving God. And Lord knows He'd taken care of my physical body with all these accidents I'd had. So I thought it's really no... I didn't pay much attention to that third step, to tell you the truth, for a little while. And I still have to, on a daily basis, address the third and 11th step to keep the will in this girl down and let God's will work in my life. And I was only about 4.5 months sober when I started asking these two women that had brought me our program, when was I supposed to do a fourth step? They knew I followed directions, and if they'd just tell me when to do it, I'd do it. And they kept saying, you'll know. And one day, I knew. But I was frightened to do it, and I, you see, I heard you in meetings say that Susie or Joe or Sam got drunk doing a fourth step. Well, I didn't want to get drunk and go to jail. So I was really afraid of it. And I went to my minister, who was very knowledgeable in their program. And he said, Martha, you have to do the fourth and fifth steps because of the cleansing steps of the program. But you can turn them into the most positive thing you've ever done. As you write each thing, say, thank God I don't have to do that again. Thank God I don't have to think that again. Thank God I don't have to feel that again. And turn everything you're writing into a positive action. And I did that. And I took a very superficial fourth step when I was just 5 months sober. But by God, it was good enough to keep me sober till I could do a thorough one. And then I realized that's what people talk about. People take drunk while they're writing the great American novel. I did enough keep me sober long enough to do a thorough one. I've done many fourth and fifth steps. But on the off chance that I had stayed sober without that first superficial one, I would not be nearly as deeply within myself as I am today. I have a loving God that would not put the burden on me of finding out all the things about Martha I've had to find out, all the unpleasant things I've had to find out. I couldn't have handled them if I'd found them in just one fourth step. So I've had to do many. And he also told me about the fifth step, that it's the one time that I could... He said, you've been justifying your behavior to me as long as I've known you. He said, it's the one time you can say everything you've ever done and felt, and you don't have to justify a word of it, you just have to do it. So I got a great deal of comfort and relief at just 5 months sober from taking a very superficial fourth and fifth step. If you're new, do one good enough to keep you sober till you can do a thorough one. I was easily aggravated when I got here. And when I was in sixth and seventh step meetings with y'all, you really aggravated me. Because what I was hearing you say on a regular basis, that God was removing all of your defects of character right now. He wasn't doing zip with mine. And I'm glad that God knows how to sift out the goofy prayers. Because if he'd have answered mine, I'd have been a vegetable. Because every time I felt something new, I prayed it away. Because I didn't know what it was. And I was expecting something very dramatic to happen. I was expecting to go to bed mean as hell and wake up Pollyanna. That's what I was expecting. And it didn't work quite that way. It's been very subtle in my life. If I am kinder to you today than I was yesterday, that is God removing my defects of character. If today I can verbalize my anger in an acceptable way, rather than using it as the blowtorch I used it for, that is God removing my defects of character. If I'm more loving and kind today than I was yesterday, I can't do that on my own. It has to be God removing my defects of character. So it's a very subtle thing in my life. The first week I was sober, I started making my amends list. And by the time I got to that step, it looked like the Houston Yellow Pages. And people told me I just wasn't that important. That probably I'd aggravated the hell out of that many people. But that I hadn't harmed that many, and that I could just get it down to a reasonable list. And my list was family and business associates. I had some serious, serious business amends to make. But there were no friends on there because I have to tell you that steamrollers don't get here with friends. I can also tell you that it's a whole lot nicer when they're accepted. But it's not necessary that they be accepted, but it's nicer. I told you I was not overly fond of my mother, and I had, through the years I had tried, the first few years in sobriety, I had tried to, about the best I could do is just keep my mouth shut. And not say all the things to her I wanted to say. And then finally, I did the best I could do with making amends to her, but I didn't feel comfortable with it. And so a few years ago on Mother's Day, I went home, and I had not spent Mother's Day with her in some 25 years, even though we're less than 250 miles apart. And that weekend, I really cleared away the wreckage of the past. And I cannot tell you how grateful I am that God got me willing just in time. Because the following September, she had a massive stroke that left her a vegetable. And I faced it with no guilt. Because God had gotten me willing just in time. And to me, that's the key with eighth and ninth step. We don't have to worry about how we're going to do it or when we're going to do it. Our only role is to get willing. And she was to remain in that state for some 3.5 years. And the last 9 months of her life, she was in a coma and didn't open her eyes. And I went through a lot of things during that 3.5 years. I got angry at God a lot and found out that's not wise. And that it doesn't get you anywhere. But I kept trying to figure out why he was keeping her alive in this state. What she could have possibly have done to have merited having to stay just alive. We had had to amputate her leg. We were about to have to amputate her arm. And, there we were just chopping pieces of her, and she didn't know anything was missing. And it was the hardest lesson I've ever had to learn in acceptance. And I had to learn to live a day at a time. All I knew about a day at a time up until that time was that I could get through bad things a day at a time. But I'd never tried living joyously a day at a time. And there's a lot of difference. So during that time, I had to learn, finally, after I had me about half crazy and all my friends crazy, with all these plans and changing plans and what if something happens with Mother, whatever, I had to learn to live joyously a day at a time, and I learned to accept God's will and to learn that God's will worked in her life the same as it worked in my life. And I was soon to find out some of the reasons that she was in that state. It gave my sister, closest to her geographically, some days of sobriety she wouldn't have had any other way, except she was taking care of Mother. And it gave this alcoholic time to learn to love her mother. Some memories came back to me that were so far in my past I didn't know they existed. Loving, warm time spent with that lady that I had no recollection of. But during that 3.5 year period, God brought them back to me one at a time and let me rejoice in them. Times of her sitting with that little tomboy, trying to teach me to embroider, doing marvelously wonderful things with me that I had completely locked away in my dislike. And I had time to love her. Not everybody in the room has a before and after picture of themselves in sobriety. And I do. I have the picture of the arrogant bitch at her father's funeral, drunk. And I have the picture of me at my mother's funeral, sober and with a measure of dignity. And you gave me that. And I'm so very grateful for it. I was real anxious to get past the ninth step, not so anxious I skipped anything. But you see, the first reading of my big book, I found their promises. And sometimes that was all that kept me sober, was thinking if I stay sober one more day, maybe these things will happen in my life. Today they have all manifested themselves in my life in one way or another, depending on how I'm working my program. And I cannot tell you how much I didn't like our tenth step, because I'd never been wrong. And I went around telling everybody I was sorry. And ladies, I wasn't sorry for nothing. But I went around saying it till I had everybody ready to scream. And then somebody said, that's not what the step says anyway. It says, promptly admit it when you're wrong. And there's an easier, softer way again. When I do something that I feel I need to say I'm sorry for, I think I've got to explain why I did what I did. When I tell you I'm wrong, that's all I got to say, is I'm wrong. I don't have to say it quite as much as I used to. And when I'm wrong, my wrongs are not as destructive as they were. I'm very careful to take an inventory each night. And I'm equally careful to see the things I've done right during the day. I don't just look at the things I've done wrong. But the 10th step is very important for me. There again, as I told you, I didn't think I would have any trouble with the 11th step either because of my relationship with my loving God. But I got mixed up somewhere along the way. I think I thought y'all were out there praying and God was sending me your answers because I stayed so busy tending to your business. And then I figured out that we'd all pray for ourselves. Everybody had somebody to pray for. And I know that I have prayed for divine guidance and received it, and nothing happened. And then it would occur to me that I hadn't quite done the step right. I'd forgotten to ask for the power to carry it out. You can get answers all you want to, baby. If you sit on your rear end, ain't nothing going to happen. So I'm very careful today when I ask for divine guidance that I also ask for the power to carry it out. I wanted to do something with that 12th step because I heard you say you had to give it away to keep it, and I wanted to keep it because I didn't want to go to jail again. And I did all the warm and wonderful things that we let new people do, like make coffee and wash ashtrays and set up meetings. It didn't do a hell of a lot for me, but I did it. And I went on some 12-step calls with ladies that had more sobriety than I. And I learned pretty early that that probably was not going to be the way I was going to be able to carry the message. The only message I have to carry is mine, my experience. And my experience was I wanted to stop drinking. because I didn't want to go to jail again. And when I'd carry the messages to these broads and they'd keep drinking, I'd want to knock the hell out of them. So we had to find another way for me to 12-step. And about this time, my group got to acting bad. And there was a man in that group with a lot of sobriety, and he said, I was going to just leave the group. We've got enough groups in Houston. I don't have to go to a bad group. And he said, there's a second line, that serenity prayer, the courage to change the things you can. You see, my group was started by one man, and he ran the group. And he appointed a chairman every month. And I don't know what he did with the money. And we didn't celebrate birthdays at that group. We went to another group he owned, and we celebrated birthdays there. So another fella that had about 30 days less than I did, he and I called a group conscience meeting. And I cannot begin to tell you how glad I am God came. Because we didn't know what one was. But that group conscience took that meeting away from its founder. And we started running that group by the traditions. And we elected a secretary and a treasurer and a GSR and an intergroup delegate. And to have our birthday celebrations and to have them an open birthday celebration so that the family could celebrate with us. And there again, we didn't know any better than to follow directions, so we started right off the service manual doing the right things with our money. Simply because we didn't know any better. And I learned a very valuable lesson at that group conscience meeting. I learned that when you go in raising hell, you always get to work. My co-hellraiser was elected their first secretary, and I was elected their first general service representative, and that's my miracle. That was my miracle. That 20-minute group conscience meeting changed the course of my entire life. Because I was still following direction. And in the Southeast Texas area, we meet in assembly once a month, second Sunday of the month. So I turned up there the second Sunday of every month at our assembly meeting. And my life took off like a comet. I started meeting people that our lives would not have touched any other way, except they were serving their group and turning up on the second Sunday of the month. And it changed the course of my life. Some of the dearest friends I have right now, I met through the service involvement. And in our area, I don't know about where you're from, but in our area, it seems to me that the service people run and go a little bit more than the others. And every time they'd say there's a convention and you're supposed to go, I went. Or a conference or a roundup. And I just stayed busy running to all these places. And then my life really started to change. Because I started hearing things that started making a real difference in my life. And I found out that I have to drive 200 or 300 miles to hear what you tell me at home. That I can't hear at home. And I know today why I can't hear it at home. When I hear a stranger at the podium, I cut out all personality and I hear principle. At my home group, I don't do that. And I had to go all the way to San Antonio to hear Paul M. say it's alcoholism, not alcoholism. And it makes no difference what you did yesterday. What are you doing today? And he also told me that anytime you're having a bad day, you're suffering from untreated alcoholism. So treat it. And I went to another state convention to hear a lady explain serenity to me so that I could understand it. She said it's not the absence of conflict in your life. It's the ability to cope with conflict in your life. And I never did turn on too much with humility. Or humbly. Until I drove 300 miles to hear this man say that humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less often. Some days I can do that. I've had to drive all these miles. I had to go all the way to New York from Houston to hear a man say you can't fall off of a building from the middle of the roof. And you can't fall out of this program if you're in the middle of it either. You got to be right on the edge. In these monthly sharing sessions, there was a group of women that would ask me on a regular basis if I would like to get fingerprinted and go into the women's state prison, and I said, hell no. I'd done that. But they just kept asking me, so I thought, well, if I'm really going to allow God's will to work in my life, maybe that's what he's trying to tell me, that's what he wants me to do. So I got fingerprinted again. And went with a group of ladies up to Huntsville, the Gorey, the women's state prison. And I was extremely afraid that day. None of the ladies in white, but I could just see them laughing me out of the hall. One night in jail, and they're doing hard time. Well, you know they did not laugh me out. They received me very warmly. And the first lady in white that I talked to one-on-one at a cigarette break that day told me my story. She'd been in a blackout, and she rear-ended a car. And the only difference in her story and my story was that the man she hit died, and the lady I hit lived. So my first time into prison, I found out exactly who was doing my time for me. Just exactly. And the first woman that I worked with that came out of prison, she'd been in that time about 3 years. And she was out less than 3 weeks, and she died drunk. And it nearly killed me. It nearly killed me. And God was with me as he always is. And he sent me to a meeting that night that I'd never been to before and I haven't been to since. And they were showing Father Martin's film Guidelines. And in that film, he says, no alcoholic ever dies drunk in vain. They buy sobriety for somebody. And Carla bought me mine. She showed me as graphically as we can show each other that it is a progressive illness, and she died right in front of me to show me. Those are a couple of the reasons why I stayed involved in Prison A for 8 years, extremely involved, and then they moved the women to North Central Texas. That's a little far for me to get there on a regular basis. But if you've never given any thought to carrying the message inside, and you're having a little trouble staying grateful, let me tell you, you can learn gratitude at a level that nothing else will teach you. Nothing else will teach you. My friend Helen and I were last Sunday up at Mountain View up in Waco, Texas, at their AA group's 11th anniversary. And it was a beautiful experience. Absolutely beautiful. Give it some thought. You're the one that will benefit by it. I know I did. It made a difference in my life. And you know, I've never known if my input into Prison AA or service amounted to a hill of beans. And I don't care. I know what it did for me. And it changed my life. Totally and completely. I could stand up here and talk till this time tomorrow about all the marvelous things that have happened to me in sobriety. Things I never even wished for. I never wished for this kind of life. How can you wish for a life that you don't know exists? And I didn't know this kind of life existed. One of the greatest joys in my life was my first sponsor. And she made a real difference in my life. She took this mess that got here and literally walked with me into sobriety. And I can see her as clear to today as I did at the time. My language was a little colorful. And as I would turn the air blue, she'd just blink. Just stand there blinking. And she never once told me to clean up my mouth. But it gradually got cleaned up. Because one of the greatest gifts she gave me was example right in front of me. I wanted what she had. I had to do what she did. The lessons she taught me were painful at the time, but I'm so grateful for them. One of the things that she did that irritated me the most, and she did a lot of things that irritated me, but I guess the thing she did that really aggravated me the most, we would have dinner on Thursday night before we'd go to my home group and a lot of times in between, and she would always pick up the dinner check. And I'd have to say, thank you. And I just hated it. I just hated to say thank you. And it'd be birthday at my group, and it wouldn't be my birthday. And she'd bring me a present. And I'd say, thank you. And that old lady had me saying thank you every time I turned around. And then I learned what she was teaching me. That you cannot give until you've learned to receive. And that you cannot receive emotionally and spiritually until you've learned to receive materially. And she took the time to teach me. She died about 6 weeks after my mother had that massive stroke. That was not a good year, but I know God fixed the burden to the back. And it's in my sixth year, he knew I could deal with these things. But the pain was so horrendous when she died, because you understand, this is the first human being I've loved unselfishly. The first human being I had ever trusted. And she was gone. Now, I don't have to tell you, I got here with a wall about that thick built around me. And we had chipped an awful lot of that wall down through the work we had done together. But a lot of it still stood. And the pain of her death was so horrendous that I had to let that wall all the way down and be willing to let anybody help me. I could no longer be selective. The pain was killing me. So even in her death, she was helping me. And she's touched every life in this room tonight. Because so many of the things I've said are the things she taught me. And I am so grateful for her. So very grateful. I'm not a whole lot smarter than I was when I got here, but I know a few things more than when I got here. And I understand today about choices that I didn't understand in the beginning. And I understand today that I can be kind or unkind. It's my choice, that it is an inside job. It doesn't matter how any of y'all act or what you do to me. What happens within Martha is Martha's doing and not yours. And I understand that today. And I understand that I can be a friend or I can be an enemy, and it's my choice. I understand all these choices that I didn't understand in the beginning. I even understand today that even though I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, that if I want to drink, I can. And I cannot begin to tell you how grateful I am that I don't choose to drink today, that I choose to be with you as we all trudge the road of happy destiny, and I thank you.